Remaining in a customs union with the EU would make it impossible for the UK to establish an independent trade policy, and render reclaiming policy areas such as agriculture and state aid an impossibility, an IEA briefing argues. With customs union membership still on the table as a way to break the Brexit deadlock, a new IEA briefing outlines how any short-term benefits of customs union membership, such as securing supply chains, would be significantly outweighed in the long run by the loss of trade opportunities and higher prices for UK consumers. Now, author of the report, Shankar Singham, director of the IEA's trade unit, highlights how a customs union would come with significant risk to UK consumers, who would lack representation in new EU trade agreements. UK consumers could also face price rises that protect EU manufacturers and find their interest ranked secondary to those of EU producers. It would also reduce the UK's influence with historic partners across the developing world. Now, on top of these drawbacks, membership of a customs union does not achieve frictionless trade, one of the supposed benefits championed by those in support of staying in a customs union. I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and joining me to discuss is Shankar himself. Hi, Shankar.
Hi.
And top Brexit wonk, who's never off the telly, Henry Newman, Director of Open Europe. Hiya, Henry.
Hello, Darren.
Now, Shankar, I want to start by saying, isn't it right, aren't those arguing for a customs union right to argue that it would help preserve those supply chains and reduce disruption after Brexit?
Well, certainly being in the customs union would allow you, for example, you wouldn't have to worry about a tariff because there would be a common external tariff under the customs union, and you wouldn't have to worry about rules of origin certification. In other words, you wouldn't have to prove origin. However, if the goal is frictionless trade, and that's the reason why some people are proposing a customs union as the solution, a customs union by itself doesn't give you that. You actually also need to be in the single market, because the rules that give are the basis for the technical checks that are necessary, rules involving technical barriers to trade and sanitary and phytosanitary measures, for example, all come from the single market. So if you haven't got that as well, then you are going to have some friction at the border. There are going to have to be some forms that would have to be filled in. And even in the case of a customs union with the EU, you would still, in addition to all of those checks, also have to fill in movement certificates. These are the certificates on customs that Turkey, for example, has to fill in exporting products into the European Union. So it doesn't solve that problem. It therefore doesn't solve the issues of the Irish border by itself. And so you have to weigh what is it actually solving versus what is it taking off the table. So what it's taking off the table is, as we've said in this paper, the UK's a significant, meaningful independent trade policy. You know, people often say, well, Turkey has an independent trade policy. Turkey has trade deals. Yes, Turkey has trade deals. The way Turkey does its trade deals is it has to follow the EU into its trade deals. It has to negotiate for the benefits of those trade deals with having given away its tariff position, because it's not in control of its tariff schedules. And so you lose the ability to have a significant trade, independent trade policy. For example, a deal with the US, for example, or acceding to the CPTPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would not be possible from inside a customs union. And the Americans and the Japanese and others have made this very clear to us. And so you'd have a minimal kind of trade policy. The other point that is often raised is that, well, you could have some influence on the Commission. Well, it's hard to see, and I think it's misguided to think, that we would have more influence in the context of a customs union with the EU than we currently have as a paying member of the EU and being a full member of the EU customs union. So I think our influence would diminish, and certainly our tariffs in any negotiations would be set by Brussels. Our trade remedies would be administered by Brussels. And the industries that would be prioritised in any trade context would be the industries that matter to the European Commission.
I mean, Henry, Open Europe's looked into this a fair bit as well. Do you agree with Shankar's pretty sort of gloomy predictions of what a customs union membership would entail post-Brexit.
So we wrote a paper on the whole question of the customs union, I think shortly after I joined Open Europe, which concluded exactly as I think along the lines of what Shankar was saying, that in the long term, it didn't make sense for the UK to be in a customs union with the EU from outside the EU. So I completely agree with that sort of that long-term problem. The question is, I think, what about the short term and what about the medium term? And I was glad to hear Shankar clarify, I think, in the way that he presented the discussion around an independent trade policy, that you would still be able to have a degree of an independent trade policy even for within a customs union. So what would a customs union actually mean for the UK? As Shankar was saying, we'd be obliged to apply the common external tariff of the EU. This would, in certain areas, particularly agricultural products, they're relatively high. On average, though, it's relatively low, less than 2%, something like 1.6%. Some particular tariffs are high, for example, on cars. But overall, we're talking about relatively low tariffs. So I think the tariffs itself are not that much of a problem. What we wouldn't be able to do, though, is do independent deals, independent comprehensive deals. For example, we wouldn't be able to do our own trade deal with, say, the United States or, say, Australia, where we have offered up our tariffs but also offered up our regulation. Now, in the long term, I think that is an issue. But in the medium term, I don't think there's any political support in the UK for changing the regulations on, say, agricultural products in the sort of way that America would require or perhaps even Australia would require. So I think there's a sort of a political disconnect in some of this. And I also think that both advocates of staying in a customs union and advocates of leaving a customs union tend to exaggerate either the benefits or the disbenefits of that customs union. So in the long term, I think we should be out the customs union and we should control our own trade policy and should be able to control our own tariffs. All of that's very important and makes sense if we're leaving the EU. It doesn't really make sense to outsource our trade policy to Brussels if we're outside the EU in the long term. But in the short to medium term, this just doesn't make very much difference. This is not going to be the key determinant of the UK's economic growth. Far more important is the overall regulatory environment that we're creating here in the UK that allows innovative people to set up businesses and create wealth and create brilliant products to export across the rest of the world and to import. And it's also worth saying that even in a customs union, which I think would be a not ideal medium-term scenario, but also not the end of the world, even in that customs union, it's only goods trade deals that we couldn't do on our own. What we could do is agree tighter and more comprehensive arrangements around services, for example. And we've obviously got a very big comparative advantage on services. The profile of our services trade is very different from our goods trade. Our goods trade is about half with the EU and the countries closely around it, whereas our services trade is only a third with Europe, because clearly we share far more in terms of language and legal system with, say, Australia, Canada, New Zealand than we do with Europe. So we could do agreements on services and reach those with our allies and friends in, say, Australia or Singapore or New Zealand, and that's where we've clearly got a lot of strengths on insurance, on banking, on financial services. We could also agree investor protection deals, so that if you are a Australian business wanting to invest in the UK, we can give you extra assurances that your protection investments here will be safe. I don't think that they've got many worries overall because you've got a very good legal system that's very fair, but we can do those sort of investor protection deals, and we can also offer mutual recognition of qualification deals. And I think this is important. So at the moment, as a result of EU membership, if you, Darren, qualified as a doctor in Lithuania or in Cyprus, you have the automatic right to work here in the UK. But that doesn't apply if you're, let's say, from Canada or New Zealand. And we could decide that actually we want to have brilliant doctors coming from the countries across the Anglosphere or even beyond, and think they should have the automatic right to come and work in our NHS, because that would contribute to a better society and a stronger economy. So we can give those automatic recognition of qualifications. And that's a sort of different sort of trade deal that would be possible even within a customs union. So I think, look, long term, yes, we should be out of the customs union and it makes sense to have our own comprehensive trade policy. But in the medium term, I think we tend to over exaggerate the importance of this as a sort of fundamental driver of whether Brexit is a success or not, or whether our economy is a success or not. Other things are perhaps more important than this.
Shankar, do you think Henry's got a point? Because we are at risk, are we not, of overlooking the services sector, which makes up the majority of Britain's economy?
Well, two things. I would agree that the services, the gains from an independent trade policy, and frankly, what are the gains from Brexit? They are the gains that come from an independent trade policy and from an independent regulatory policy. That's where the gains are. If you don't have those, then you don't really have anything. But the problem with the services negotiation is if you talk to any of the major parties with whom we would want to get further services liberalisation, services is one of the most difficult areas to liberalise because many of the barriers to services are behind the border barriers or market distortions, basically. And so to get countries to move on those, you have to be able to give them something. You have to be able to have flexibility over your goods tariff schedules, over your agricultural tariff schedules, and certainly in the context of the countries that were mentioned by Henry, the Australians, the New Zealands, and the US and others, they will want the UK to be at least able to be flexible with respect to its regulatory system. That doesn't mean we have to change anything. We may get to a point where the gains we are being offered by those countries in the context of services or other areas are simply not enough to justify a change in the regulatory system, for example. So that's one thing I would say. You need to have as maximum flexibility as you can in order to get those services gained.
Can I just come back in quickly on one point? I think that's obviously true that it'd be better to have both the independent trade flexibility to choose our overall tariff schedule and offer those up as a quid pro quo for better access from services. Totally agree. But there are countries like Singapore, which has basically no tariffs at all on any of its products. I mean, like 99% of products are tariff-free across the world. And yet Singapore has been able to do trade deals incorporating services, not just good trade deals, which have improved its access to imports by cutting the tariffs on other trade partners, but also has improved its services aspects. So, I mean, I accept that being able to shift your regulatory environment is important, but it's not just having control of tariffs is not crucial to that. And of course, even if we were in the customs union with the EU, we would be able to change the regulations across our wider economy and particularly across our services, which is again where, as Darren was saying, even though services aren't a majority of our exports, they are a majority of our, very strong majority of our domestic economy, and we'd have full control over how we regulated those sectors.
Yeah, but I mean, the issue with Singapore and the issue with small countries that are able, like Chile and others, that are able to have lots of trade agreements is it depends what the other party wants. No large agricultural exporter is going to be fighting for the Singaporean market because it's just too small. Now, what the other countries want, it's important. It's not just the size of our market. You know, we are the fifth biggest economy in the world and all the rest of it. But what matters to them, and this is the crux of the issue on the regulatory side. It's often suggested that it's about whether you choose the US or the EU or the Chinese or whatever regulatory environment. That's not actually what it is. It's a choice between the interoperability, the operating system of the world, if you will. Is it going to be a regulatory system based on adequacy and equivalence and mutual recognition, which is the underlying WTO and international trading framework? Or is it going to be based, as the EU is increasingly moving to, regulatory identicality? I mean, if you're not identical with our regulatory system, you're not going to have market access. So it's basically things like GDPR, REACH, chemicals regulation. A lot of the recent European regulation is that. That's the battle, and that's where countries like the US and Australia and New Zealand and the CPTPP 11 and so forth are very concerned. And that's where they're looking at the UK and saying, well, you're G5. You know, if you move into that environment from the European environment, that's a big deal. That's a very big change. So that's what they're going to want. And the other aspect of this is timing. Because we, let's assume that the Prime Minister's deal or some variant of it actually passes before October, so that we leave the European Union. You know, we're going to leave the European Union with an implementation period, which is going to go to December 2020 and, you know, possibly after that. So we do have a medium term where we can negotiate with other parties, and that's going to expire, you know, potentially in 2022. So there is a moment on trade negotiations that you have to take advantage of. We have a window of opportunity with the US, which really is going to take us through to March of next year when the primary season in the US really kicks off seriously. You've got July 2021 when the president will lose trade negotiating authority. And this Congress is unlikely to give the president trade negotiating authority without some major gains to be shown, and that's primarily going to be in agriculture. And you've got CPTPP, where we could essentially start the accession process as soon as we leave, whereas if we wait too long to be able to do that credibly, then we are no longer going to be one of the first new accession members of the TPP. So I think there is a sense of urgency here, and certainly that is being felt by the rest of the world. And they will, if we are too long in a process where we can't credibly say that we're going to have a serious independent trade policy, they will lose interest in us, and we will cease to be relevant to them. And increasingly, they will, their trade associations and their business groups will say, well, we're just going to wait and see what your ultimate, you know, destination point with the EU is.
That's what we're all doing, aren't we?
Because if they do that, and as I've told them, if you do that, you're simply going to force the UK to lock in to Europe, the European regulatory system, at which point those critics of Brexit who've said, well, we're just going to be smaller than the EU, but identical in other respects, will be right. And the rest of the world will just say, well, that's not the advantage that we thought was going to occur.
Henry, I wanted to go back to, you mentioned the sort of the politics of it and the fact that there actually isn't that support in Parliament for leaving the customs union in either houses. Why do you think then that the customs union membership has come back on the table? Obviously, Her Majesty's government are trying to use it as a sort of a bargaining chip, but they're failing to actually get that over the line because, one, it would it split the Conservative Party? Would you agree with that? And why are Labour not coming on board? Isn't the withdrawal agreement, doesn't it include a customs union?
So there's an incredible amount of unreality about all the debate in Westminster at the moment. And one of the remarkable things is that we spent 3 years arguing about the exact same things with greater feelings each time and perhaps fewer facts. But I mean, I think the reason the customs union is still on the table is because everything's still on the table, because none of the actual decisions of Brexit have really been taken. We've got the exact same choices now, at some level, that we've had ever since we first began. Leave with a deal, leave without a deal, or don't leave. And everything else is different dressings around that. And what people who are advocating a customs union, I think, are often looking for is a proxy for a softer relationship that isn't the single market. Because they think politically free movement is unsustainable, so they don't want to be in a free movement relationship. But if you're a sort of Labour person who wants to be respecting the referendum result, trade deals are not really the thing that your constituents are particularly motivated by. So you can say, I want a softer Brexit. It's, look, we want a customs union. That's therefore a definitively softer Brexit than the government is going for. Of course, the Labour Party don't want to admit that there already is a customs union in the current deal until a future relationship can be found that meets the requirements of the getting rid of the backstop. And the Conservatives don't want to say that is the case either, because that undermines the Prime Minister's argument. So you've got this sort of bizarre argument going on. I share Shanker's point about the possibility of other countries losing interest in us only to a degree, because I think that the prospects of getting a US trade deal through this parliament are completely zero. The only way you could really do that and move very much more towards a system of a much more open regulatory environment with the US would be a very big Conservative majority, having been won on the back of a manifesto promising something like that. The last time the Conservatives won a good majority was, I think, 1987. The last time any party won a good majority was 2005. So, you know, we're in a difficult world at the moment where compromise is needed. And politics isn't just the art of the possible, but politics is the art of choosing between the unpalatable and the disastrous. And I think that however much I may personally want to be out of the customs union, I don't think that's really that relevant. I think, to go back to your overall points about the economic benefits of Brexit coming from independent trade policy and independent regulatory policy, yes, that's true to a degree, but it's also true that Brexit just doesn't make that much difference economically either way. I think most people who wanted to leave because they wanted to be out of the EU's political project and they wanted to take control of their sovereignty and their laws and just the way that decisions were made in this country. I think they like the idea of trading more with different countries and having control of our trade policy, and that's important in the long term, as I've been saying. But it's not, I don't think, the single biggest motivator for Brexit. The biggest motivator for Brexit was controlling our own decisions in this country. So we shouldn't overstate the importance of it. Now, I think once you've taken the decision to leave, from that flows lots of things. So I don't think we could be in a long-term position where Brussels decides our trade policy. That just doesn't work. I think we have to find a way where we can't be treated just like Turkey. But as you said, Shanker, we're much bigger than Turkey. So the reality is, since the referendum, the EU is locked in a trade deal with Japan. That's changed quite a lot of the picture. So at the time of the referendum, we were able to stand up on the Leave campaign and say, well, look, the EU hasn't done a deal with any of the world's big economies. Now the EU has done a deal with one of the EU's world's biggest economies, Japan, and that's materially changed the picture. A deal with China is not going to happen because China's got an incredibly advantageous position in the WTO. And a deal with the US is, I think, politically very difficult. So then you get to what's the next fruits that you could actually realistically pick from the EU side? Australia and New Zealand. That's obviously where the EU's focusing their talks. If the EU is about to do a deal with Australia, that we're not going to be treated like Turkey, even if we're in a de facto customs union or a de jure customs union with the EU. Australia, Canberra and New Zealand are going to want to sit down with the UK and work out what... So we're going to have a de facto seat at the table in those discussions, even if we don't really legally have one by necessity. So I think, you know, would that be perfect? No. Would it be the end of the world? No. I mean, I think there's a world you can imagine where the EU is doing a trade deal with Australia in 3 or 4 years' time, and the UK is basically consulted, given some sort of say. So I think one of the things in all this, which is interesting, is actually Jeremy Corbyn's policy of a customs union with a say over trade is undeliverable now, but in the future, it may not be undeliverable.
I mean, Shankar, I was listening to the Japanese ambassador to the EU on Sky News this morning, and he was arguing that the United Kingdom was a key voice for that open liberalisation in that trade agreement with Japan. Where, if we lose that seat at the table, aren't we just sort of going to end up with more protectionist trade agreements through the EU customs union?
Well, you can actually see it with Japan, because the reason, while we have actually had more success than I think the media reports in terms of the rolling over of these trade deals that we have with the EU, that we have through the EU, we've actually done relatively well with most of them, except for Japan. Japan and Korea to some extent, Korea for different reasons, but with respect to Japan, the Japanese don't want the UK-Japan relationship to be governed by the principles of the EU-Japan agreement. They don't like the EU-Japan agreement. They had to do things on data they didn't particularly want to do. They had to do a number of things that they don't think it's a particularly great agreement. Now they want access to the European Union, so obviously they've done the deal. But I would pick on a couple of things. One is the economic gains of Brexit, because I think this has not been well expressed over the last 2 or 3 years. What the economic gains of Brexit in terms of your independent trade policy are determined by what is the global trading system at the moment. You know, where is it going? Is it delivering on greater liberalisation? If it was delivering on greater liberalisation, if we were in a 1997 kind of moment where we've just negotiated a big comprehensive trade round and we're doing services deals on a multilateral basis, then you could make an argument that the impact of the UK's other agreements and the impact of the UK in the WTO would be not particularly significant. But that's not the case. We've had 25 years almost of virtually no progress in the WTO. The services cupboard has been completely bare. Inability, even in the regional trade agreements, to get meaningful services liberalisation. And as Henry said, the services is a huge part of our economy. So that's one thing. The second thing is, what is the direction of travel of European regulation? If that is in fact in, as I believe it to be, in a more anti-competitive and prescriptive direction, and accelerating, and as you point out, without us at the table, that acceleration will continue. Then I think you could say, if that were different, if the Europeans were moving in a pro-competitive direction, then I would say, well, there's limited gains from the UK, but I actually think the economic gains of Brexit are potentially, if we do it right, if we actually liberalise our own economy, if we move towards more pro-competitive regulation ourselves, if we have trade deals that give us greater liberalisation, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not just about our producers. It's about the overall economic effect in terms of reduction of distortions and so on. I think the gains are potentially very large. Now, I do agree with Henry that the customs union is often used in the parliamentary debate, devoid as it is of facts, as a sort of proxy for a softer Brexit. And some people just want a softer Brexit. And the problem here is that there are other forms that aren't talked about in terms of the UK's relationship with the European Union, notably, as Greg Hands and David Davis launched recently, a comprehensive UK-EU free trade agreement. The difference between a comprehensive trade agreement with a very advanced customs and trade facilitation chapter and a customs arrangement, such as the one that the Prime Minister has been talking about, are not that enormous.
That's exactly right. I think there's this sort of madness where Shanker's saying, like, what people really want from the customs union is clearly tariff and quota-free trade.
Right, exactly.
Those are the single biggest benefits. Now, obviously, rules of origin is a different issue and an important issue, which some people want to see addressed as well. But people often use these terms without fully understanding
them. Yeah. And also, the point about rules of origin, you know, a lot of this is, you know, people don't fully understand what is the actual cost of filling in customs forms and those sorts of things. I mean, people assume that the moment you have to fill in a customs form or prove origin, suddenly trade stops. Well, it doesn't. In fact, there are many companies that do actually do lots of customs forms now in terms of their trade with the rest of the world. Tate & Lyle, for example, uses, I think, it's about 1.5 people for their global operations who spend time working on customs. It's about 0.04% of their global operating budget. So these are not big numbers. And you have to, again, it's always a trade-off. It's always about weighing what is the cost, the increased cost of customs clearance. And I think we can solve the tariff and quantitative restrictions problem with a trade agreement. We can actually solve a lot of the clearance problems with a trade agreement. And we're moving to more and more advanced customs operations and faster clearance anyway, even regardless of all of these arrangements.
I think that's exactly right. So you can talk about the kind of, our chairman, Simon Wolfson, talks about his experience from Next, where, you know, clearly, what do you want out of a customs union? You want the tariffs are the main issue that people want resolved, and that's obviously resolved anyway through a comprehensive trade agreement. The other side is the bureaucracy. But actually, if you look at it, if you've got a good control of your stock, then you know where your goods are moving anyway. But I think there's another area of unreality there around all of this, that exactly as Shanker was saying, what we really need is customs facilitation agreements with our trading partners too. We've already got one of those with the US, but we need more of those, and we need those ultimately with the EU so that we can leave the customs union and have a free trade style arrangement with other bits added on. But then one of the things I don't understand is why some of the hardline Brexiteers are so worried about the political declaration talking about having a future relationship that builds on the customs arrangements in the backstop. Surely we want to have facilitated customs with the EU from outside a customs union. That's literally a perfect relationship. It's a relationship where we have control of our trade policy, the ability to set tariffs and do our own trade deals in the long term, but also facilitated customs. And yet, many of the hardline Brexiteers seem determined to take that out of the political declaration.
Yeah, so I think this is a very interesting semantic point about how people read these documents. And I think one of the concerns that people have about things like the single customs territory language and the political declaration and building on the backstop arrangement is the notion that this will be used in leverage in the negotiation that we might ultimately ever get to with the European Union in the second phase. It's the revealed preference of the EU through these negotiations, in my view, following this, is that they want us in a customs union, single market type arrangement where we are restricted in what we can do around the world, because they are genuinely concerned about what we might do around the world, and they're genuinely concerned about us becoming more competitive than they are. And so one of the things that they are that people are concerned about is that they will use any leverage that they can to affect that result. And I actually think that if we were to say to the European Union now, we just want more language in the political declaration that says that nothing in the political declaration requires the UK to be in a customs union or the customs union with the European Union, and that the political declaration allows a multitude of options in phase two, including a free trade agreement, I am certain that the European Commission would be fine with that.
I think, to be honest with you, given the state of British politics at the minute, this entire podcast could be quite useless in the next week or so. But thank you very much, Henry and Shanker, for joining me today. You can read Shanker's report on the customs union, his briefing on the customs union, on the IEA website at iea.org.uk, and do let us know at IEA London if you've changed your mind. Are you now pro the customs union? Are you against the customs union? Has your mind not changed at all? IEA London, thank you very much.